I probably would want to check with Senator Holmberg to make sure, but I don't expect there to be any problem.
Okay, well, thank you, sir.
You want me to do that?
Yes, I think that should be part of our study here.
Okay. Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to relate back to what Representative Forseth was talking about, and he was looking for a different percentage on that up and down, and I just wanted to get, see if John would confirm something for me. It's my understanding in the 1981 Supreme Court ruling that the legislature was not instructed that assessments had to be 100%. As a matter of fact, the Supreme Court was requested by the parties to make it at 100%, and the Supreme Court decided that they would not set that and it would be left up to the legislature. My point being, rather than changing the up and down 5% or changing the up and down 10% or 25%, which I think if it gets high enough, that would encounter problems, the point that you start at could be set statewide at 90% of assessment, at 75, at 85. I mean, so just another way of thinking about it. Is that correct, John?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Owens, yeah, I would agree with that, that as long as what is done meets the Supreme Court's idea of uniformity, it's okay. And obviously the court can't say 100%. It's got to be, because nobody really knows for sure what 100% is. So there's got to be some flex there. But as the chairman said, 25 or 30%, I think, would clearly be too much flex.
Okay, go ahead.
The other thing about that levy limit, the alternative one where you get the same dollars, that has become important for a reason that it didn't exist before. When the property tax, the mill levy reduction grant program started, school district unlimited mill levy authority was eliminated, and a requirement was put in that school districts having excess levy authority would have to have a vote on that issue by 2015. To extend that excess levy authority. It was recognized at that time that if the voters at that election said no, you don't have excess levy authority anymore, that district would get kicked back to 185 mills, then 110 mills, and now under current law down to 60 mills from wherever they were previously. That would be a substantial cut out of what they have to operate with, except for the existence of this section that says they can have the same dollars as last year. If the voters say no to excess levy, those districts would then have the same dollars, but as I pointed out, that would not include assessment increases, only new property. So over time, that would erode down and bring that district to a point where the 60 mills of levy authority is the cap that would apply to them, because that allows assessment increases as well. So anyway.
Representative Forseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more comment on the equalization. And so I think the voters' frustrations a lot is that they probably understand that they have to be equalized, but if the local taxing district has all the money they need, or probably not what they want, they can always lower their mills, but they never do. And I think that's what frustrates taxpayers as much as anything. So if you have the equalization process where it is, and they don't need all that money, they can always have the option of lower mills. And I think that the taxpayer would never see those mills go down. So I think that's part of their frustration. And I don't know if there's anything we can do about that.
Representative Forseth, I anticipate that this committee is going to look very closely at that, especially with the amount of relief that we gave in the last session. There's been written correspondence with local governments. There's been some conversations I've had with them, and the information that they can provide us. And I would hope that the mill rates will be set across this state in October of all of our political subdivisions. I would hope that by January, and I think that the counties especially will be able to gather this information. It's my goal that come January, we can look at every taxing district and find out exactly what percentage of property tax relief they ended up with. And if they didn't end up with the amount that we anticipate they would, we'll be able to understand why they didn't. And so it's, we will do that, and we will look at that, and, but you're right, that's, we'll see where they're lowering the mills and where they're not. Go ahead, John. Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And John, you had talked about the education, and that they would have 60 mills. As I understand, the 60 mills was the deduct. And then there would be 10 mills beyond that. And if they have to go over that, it's by a vote of the people. Well, but they also have discretionary 12 mills that isn't in effect the first year of that. So the 60 mills is a deduct. They only have really 10 mills, and I know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelch, I believe it's a 50 mil deduct from the new legislation, where we were buying down to 110, we now buy down to 60, and then as you indicated, there's 12 mils discretionary that can be added to that, but there's a restriction there on how much of that 12 mils they can take in the first year, so.
Well, the point is, Mr. Chairman, one of the school districts in my area, not in my district, but is an impasse, and they said they have absolutely no new money, can leverage no new money from locally. So they, anyway, they ended up with about the same amount as all. So they were in some deep trouble with the raises and making sure all the other things were met. So anyways, but I think it went to 60 mils in the final hours of the legislative session. The deduct went from 50 to 60.
Yeah.
And then
I thought it went from 60 to 50.
No, it was 50 at one time. Then
I don't like using the word deduct. I look at it as a minimum mill levy went from 50 to 60. We'll get the facts out.
It's the same thing. Okay. But the trouble is there's some districts in that area who got a lot more money, and some didn't get any either. So it makes it difficult for some of the school districts that are a little smaller, maybe losing some people. That's what really hurts them.
Representative Kelch, again, I would hope that as we do our work and move forward, we'll be able to see what every school district was forced to do with their mill rate and what they did do with their mill rate as a consequence of this last bill that we passed.
Thank you.
Representative Ruby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing too is we look dealing with we have a memorandum on the caps that for mill levies, but are we looking out also where we have the minimums, as you mentioned, where some of the political subdivisions couldn't lower them? And I don't know if there's very many that they can't, but there are some, such as farm to market roads, where they can lower the mill, but if they go below a certain amount, they lose state funding. So we have some incentives for them not to lower the mills below a certain level. And I don't know if there's many of those. Maybe it's something we should also take a look at and see where we're at with those.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the memo goes through assessment of locally assessed property, how values are to be determined. I won't go through that in great detail, except with regard to the agricultural property valuation formula. There was, in 2004, an artificial floor that was set in the cap rate that's used in the ag valuation formula. And over a period of years, that artificial floor was phased down, and over that time, the existence of that artificial floor held agricultural property values down from where they would have been under the formula. Now, I don't know if farmers during that time were patting you on the back, but in 2012, that artificial floor disappeared, and we had a significant bump in agricultural values statewide, and I bet they told you about that. That's a one-time thing, and hopefully won't happen again, but just an illustration of what happens when things in that formula are tinkered with. It has a lasting effect, and when the chickens come home to roost, they don't remember the savings, they remember the bump. Anyway.
John, because of the way we assess the different classifications of property, and you combine that with this budget options local governments have, 57-1501-1, where they're guaranteed the same revenue in dollars, as we've seen the ag property in this state, because of the formula, go up in value, isn't it true that there is tax burden shift from city and or residential and commercial property to ag property?
Absolutely. There's a shift that goes on when
one class,
any class of property, rises or falls more than the other classes, because and that's another reason for uniformity statewide, because you may think that value way over on the other side of the state doesn't affect you, but it does.
And when ag property was going down in the 80s, that shift was going the other way?
It was going, yes, absolutely. A lot of burden was shifted to residential and commercial and centrally assessed from ag land. And then when interest rates began to decline as steeply as they did, some of that burden shifted back. And we can look at some statistics historically to see how that happens. Obviously, not all property values are going to rise at exactly the same rate. So there is some shifting that goes on every year. Down toward the bottom, there's a little paragraph. If a parcel of property has an assessment increase by at least $3,000 and 10% of the property's value, notice has to be sent out to that taxpayer that that assessment increase has happened, and it's got to be sent out soon enough to allow the taxpayer to participate in equalization board meetings. I've distributed copies to you. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe I didn't. Did I distribute copies of those letters from the officials from Williston?
Yes.
Okay. The city of Williston and Williams County, we all know property values there have been going nuts. In a good way. Values are increasing tremendously. And this 10% increase factor, which in some areas of the state is well above what happened, in Williams County, almost every parcel of property in the county. And these notices have to be sent out, and these letters are just to express some concern to the committee about the way this has worked out for the folks in Williston. Having to send out all these notices is a significant cost. I think once those local Board of Equalization hearings are completed, it would be interesting to ask them if attendance was up this year as a result of the notices and the increases. There's some information about payments in lieu of taxes. I won't go through that. On page 3, property tax statistics. 2012, statewide property and special taxes, $829 million. That's an increase of 7.6% from that comparable amount in 2011. 7.6% more property tax dollars. Now, I don't know investment returns, but a 7.6% increase means doubling every, how many years? Any bankers?
10 years.
Doubling every 10 years. So if property taxes in the state double every 10 years, well, I don't have to tell you what that means.
We won't be able to have a legislative session with no property tax bills, that's for sure.
Now, the constitutional one mill levy for the State Medical Center, $2.8 million. That's an increase of 14.3% from 2011, from that one mill levy. Now, that's imposed on every parcel of property in the state at the same rate, one mill. So 14.3% increase in revenue means valuations went up 14.3% statewide. So I just thought that was interesting. Then I put together a little chart. Percentage statewide property taxes levied by political subdivision category in 2012. School districts, 46%. Those of you who have been looking at these numbers for a while can remember the days when that was about 57% and possibly even a little higher.
Question.
The percentage, oh.
Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I just want to be clear. The $829.2 million in property tax, that's after all the state legislative buy-down money that we poured into it, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The right-hand column there, just a 10-year comparison by subdivision of what their total statewide levy was in 2003 against 2012 and what the percentage increase is, so that you can see where the growth rates fall. It looks like during that time period there's been about an 89% increase in valuation statewide. So for the most part, the major taxing entities are below that 89% assessment number when dollars levied is considered. Mr. Chairman, Senator Sarbuck.
Excuse me, Senator Sarbuck.
Mr. Chairman and John, but that's just the valuation of all the property. I mean, there's no consideration in here. A lot of this is self-inflicted by improvements. Additional commercial property took farmland to now $10 million building, or you developed a quarter and put 200 homes that are worth millions. So the 7.6% isn't just assessors went out and said all the value is worth 7.6 more. There's a lot of improvement in that valuation increase.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sorbach, absolutely, and I should have mentioned that. I don't have information on how much of that's from new and how much of it's from value rising. I think that we should discuss with the tax department or political subdivision representatives if we could get a handle on that. Yeah. There's some information in here about state funding to political subdivisions. Attached as an appendix is a chart showing major state appropriations and revenue allocations for direct assistance to political subdivisions over five bienniums. And looking at those numbers, I think that you will agree that legislative assistance to political subdivisions has been vastly increased. 0305, about $1 billion, if you look at page M29. And the current biennium, about $3.75 billion. So, what is that, 270-some% increase in state assistance. And in the memo, there's some discussion about comparing those increases. I won't go through that, except to say it's pretty clear that legislative action has held property taxes at a much lower level than they would have been without it. We can debate what that percentage is and how it should be stated, you know, the 40%, 25%, 10, whatever. But clearly, legislative action has held property taxes at a much lower level than they would have been. Home rule sales tax revenues. I included this information, as the chairman said, that has become a very significant revenue source. Just about every city that has any kind of retail sales has a local sales tax. And the revenue numbers, there's a table set out there. As you can see, just like state sales tax collections, there has been kind of explosive growth in the money that comes in from home rule sales taxes. There's a little bit of information on special assessments. As the chairman indicated, I kind of consider, and I think most people do, that special assessment revenues is kind of part of the property tax consideration. As the chairman said, property taxes could be substituted for special assessments and vice versa. So I think it's fair game for discussion by this committee. There's a review of the property tax relief legislation from 2007, 2009, 2011. I won't go through that. Most of you have lived through that. Then there's a review of 2013 property tax legislation. The things that happened most recently. I won't go through that either unless there are some issues that the committee wants me to talk about. So, what I hope we can have is some discussion like we've had already of things that the committee would like information on, more in-depth report, see if we can develop some data or something. Because, as the chairman said, this is going to be a very significant discussion topic again, and this committee should be the most well-armed legislators, information-wise, that we have going into next session.
Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in achieving that goal, I have a clarification question for you, John. On page 3, where you're talking about levied 2003 through 2012, let's just take school districts, for example. You show a 15.8% increase, but because of the time frame you're referencing and comparing one to the other, correct me if I'm wrong, but that says that the legislative buy-down of the school levies was eaten up, and it increased 15.8% between that 10-year period, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Owens, yeah, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
A lot of that could have happened prior to that, too. You'd almost have to look at 2009 to 2013 and see what that rate is.
Yeah, there's a if it's graphed, there's a kind of a horn. It rose, dropped, and then begins rising again. But the growth slope, essentially, the cost of education spending in the state appears to be on about the same plane of growth. It just has the drops where legislative funding has taken some of the load off taxpayers.
Committee, in the last few years, last few sessions, we have seen a lot of legislation introduced dealing with tax relief or tax reform that did not pass. But I think if you look at all the legislation that was introduced, you will find that that legislation touches just about every part of the property tax argument that you have. For example, last session, I'm the one who introduced it, a bill that gave voters another option if they disagreed with what their assessed value was. It passed the Senate, we couldn't get it through the House, and it needed work, I grant that. But that's an area, again, where I made a comment at the beginning, where taxpayers have no say in either their assessment or the mill rate. Is there something that we can do to make them more comfortable with that their assessment is fair? So I would argue that maybe we should take a look at that bill draft just as a discussion point to start a discussion on what we might be able to do to improve the assessment process. We've talked about caps. We've had numerous bills dealing with caps. There's a lot of different places you can put a cap on. You can cap the budget. You can cap the growth. You can cap the mill rate. We should probably put them on the table just to see, not to consider the bill draft, but to consider the issue and look at the debate and the discussion that we had to see if there is something that we might be able to do with that issue. And I'm wondering if, I'm sure there are others too, but I'm wondering if it wouldn't be wise for us as we try to study property tax just to look at failed legislation and see why it failed. Was it a good idea? Was it a bad idea? Or do we need to try to build on that idea? Your thoughts? Is that all right with other comments from you folks as far as Representative Casper?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was another issue in the last session, and that was attacking property tax relief for seniors through an increased homestead tax credit, which did not pass. And, you know, one of the public policy issues that I felt strongly about on that point was, what is our public policy in regard to seniors when they retire to be able to help them stay in their homes? And so I think that's an issue of...
You did pass that.
No, we passed a different bill. We didn't pass the one I introduced, but... We did something, but not very much from my perspective. So I think the homestead tax credit for seniors is another issue that should be re-looked at during this interim committee hearing.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dotsenrod.
Yes, and John, again, on this table on page 3, where you show the school districts at the top of a column, the first column there, 46.18, and that's for 2012. I mean, after, it's my impression after what we did in this last session, that isn't probably a very accurate representation of where we are today, is it? I mean, we would, if we could update this or get information that based on what the last legislature did, that number, I'm guessing, would be quite a bit less. I mean, it's the biggest share of the property tax bill, but and maybe still is, but I think that I don't know if we're going to get new numbers, and it may take a while before we get all that in to know it, but that should be quite a bit smaller, I would think, now.
I anticipate our next meeting will be in October, and then we'll have a meeting in January. And there may be two-day meetings, but that information you're looking at, I would hope that we are getting close to seeing it in January. Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to follow up with that, a couple of years before that number would have been about 60%, 59 or 60%, in some cases higher. But so there was some effects of property tax buy-down to the schools at that point.
We hear a lot of arguments that the property tax relief we have given is no longer being realized, it's been eaten up, and we'll find out to what degree that is truly happening, I would hope. Other comments, other things you want to look at? Now's a good time. Representative Headland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, does this study allow us to monitor some of the reforms we put into place this past session, such as the fact that when the budgeting process occurs, the political subdivision now has to lower the levy to reflect the same amount of dollars? And I think if we monitor that, we should be able to see exactly, you know, what is occurring as far as percentages of increases through that. And I think it's something that we would like to see here.
We will see it. Representative Casper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another topic just dawned on me is the building funds that the political subdivisions have to be able to build buildings without a vote of the people. And there's two instances in my county right now. The city of Fargo has announced they're going to build a $12 to $14 million new civic center. And about a month ago, it was a discussion in the newspaper, and this week or last week, it's now the headlines, they're going forward to build it. And West Fargo School District, the headlines in the paper, I have the paper here. Tuesday, July 23rd, West Fargo decides to finance school without a public vote. And they're citing their ability to raise the funds with their building fund and with their tax levy. So I think that's what loopholes are we allowing there that ought to be looked at, which obviously new buildings increase property taxes one way or the other.
We had legislation dealing with that last session.
I think there was an attempt.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Headland, and then Representative Frost.
Mr. Chairman, just one more thing. I was wondering if it would be possible that this committee could track the progress of the study that you and I have talked about that is in another committee dealing with standardizing procedures amongst political subdivisions. And I believe Mr. Walstead probably will be working in that area, and maybe he could report to this committee, you know, the progress and how things are going along with that study, because I believe that is an important piece of property tax to look at. And you know, if we're going to be making some moves in the future, that may be an important a way to do it. But I'd like to be able to look at that if we can, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we'll check on that. I'm sure we can look at it. Whether or not we weigh in on it when it's in another committee might be a different issue. And my guess is you would like to weigh in also.
I believe you're probably...
It's very easy to track. There's minutes to read. But I was surprised that study wasn't here. It is in another committee, and certainly don't want us to study it, too. Representative Froseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, are we going to take a look at any possible ways that the state can get out of buying down property taxes in the method that we have been doing? I think we're digging ourselves a hole that the state isn't going to be able to continue to afford in future years. And I think we should look at an end game and how we just get out of paying a portion of property taxes, and the way to do that, I guess, is to send more money back to the state in other manners instead of tying ourselves to that property tax issue.
That can certainly be discussed, Representative Froseth. I assume it would start with a good idea how to do it, and I welcome your idea or ideas.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelsch.
Well, I think the education bill was, you know, was a start in that direction. We talked about it being property tax relief. It was property tax relief in as much as the state sent enough money back for the schools to operate, or way more than they were getting before. And so they have to levy less property tax. That's true, but that's, and I think he hit it right on the head. If you're going to limit property tax, and we've got this money, we better be distributing out to the local subdivisions so they don't have to levy property tax. That's property tax relief. And you can, you don't have to call it property tax relief, you can call it funding the counties, the cities, school districts, and whatever. So they don't have to levy the property tax. That's been a pretty common sense solution, I think.
Representative Kelch, I don't know when enough is enough. We could send more money to political subdivisions, I believe, and pretty soon our property tax bill is probably going to be again high, where the voters are going to come to us and demand relief. I would argue that I think a lot of times we hear arguments and we think that the blame of all this is our local elected folks who raised the property tax, the counties, the schools, and the cities. I would argue that maybe it's not necessarily them as much as it is the people who elect them and all of the services that they demand. And I think that when you look at the services that all of us demand from our local government, we have a hard time, at least a lot of people do, connecting that demand with the fact that somebody's got to pay the bill. And the perfect example in my mind, I use it all the time, is I can sit at a coffee table and I want snow gates, and I hear that, I want snow gates, and the next breath is, you got to cut my property tax. Well, you can't have both, so go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with that, that the people demand certain services. They want their roads opened out in the rural areas as soon as it's possible to get them opened, because they have business to attend. But I don't, you know, if you look at what the state budget's done over the years, since 2007, 2009, and I can't tell you the exact figures, but it's some pretty big figures, and probably look at what counties and cities' budgets has done, I'll bet the counties and cities is less increases than what the state has increased. And some of it's from money going back, I don't get me wrong, but, you know, we kind of sit and criticize those folks for doing what they have to do, and then say, well, we had to do it, and so our budgets went up to $13.6 billion or whatever it was this past year, and say, well, if theirs went up 10%, they're not efficient. And that's just wrong, because they have the same problems and same expenses that state government has.
The most surprising figure I see here is the amount of money going to political subdivisions, when John points out that it went from $1 billion 10 years ago to $3.7 billion today. On top of that, we are spending a lot of money on property tax relief. Ultimately, the only way you lower taxes is reduce services or find efficiencies. And that's where it's at. Other comments before we take a break?
Just a quick one, Mr. Chairman. Just listening to the discussion, I think that it would be useful, I don't know if it's possible, but if maybe the Association of Counties, League of Cities, School Boards Association could provide some help, to not just look at the growth in local spending, but by category, to allow the committee to understand what are the drivers. Is it salaries? Is it fuel costs? Is it insurance? Is it unemployment insurance? Is it
definitely.
I don't know if that's feasible, but I think it would be worth exploring.
Yes, I agree. Representative Senator Sorbach.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that too, because at some point we can't just talk about what we're doing property tax, that they're overspending, that they're cutting and all this, without taking a serious look. What are their budgets? If you're saying there's all this excess, let's see where it's at, because, I mean, I know there's issues, and no one will disagree with that, but the tax relief we're getting is not new dollars. It's replacing the taxpayer dollars. So it isn't like we gave $800 million more to the political subs in the schools. There's still, we're helping the taxpayer, and I don't know how long we can keep doing it either, because we've kind of dug a hole. But in all fairness, and I think there is another study, like you said, on it, but we need to look at, as John said, about the budgeting process to make this fair. And if we're saying there's excess and we're not doing their job, then we need to point it out at some point. So I would hope the committee could address that some manner.
Costs a lot more for a family of four to live today than it did 10 years ago. And costs more to run government, too. I handed you out a copy. This is a form editorial that I think touches on the question. This is a study that is also in Committee on Intergovernmental Relations, but you know, it points to the point, and its efficiency sometimes is where we might reduce costs, and just for your reference. But any other comments or discussion on that first study memo? Committee, let's take 10 minutes. Let's come back here at 10:25. We will recess. We'll call the Tax Interim Committee back to order, and we get Senator Dotson Rod to grab his seat, and John, you got another memo?
Oh, I've always got another memo.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the next thing on the agenda, controlling growth of property tax levies. Background memorandum. It's really short. Could have been really long. There are four specific focuses listed in the study directive. First of all, whether property tax relief that's getting through to taxpayers is commensurate with the amount of state funds distributed. Tough one to answer. It's going to require looking at a lot of data. The second thing, additional cost to the state of picking up funding for some social service functions, and how much of that is passed through to taxpayers. Once again, a lot of data will be necessary. Third thing is whether voter approval through a referral or levy and budget restrictions should play a greater role in local taxing decisions. That, you know, is a judgment call, and the schedule of dates in the property tax year indicates there are some difficulties with that, but that is something the committee is supposed to focus on. And then the feasibility of more restrictive property tax limits. So, those are the areas of study. The memo talks about legislation. Obviously, we were very active. We had four constitutional amendments relating to property tax issues. We had more than 40 bills last session relating to property tax issues, and that doesn't even begin to measure the amendments to other bills. That's just introduced bills. And, you know, we had Measure 2 last interim to eliminate property tax, and it certainly heightened the public discussion of property tax issues, local control, and all of those things. So this is not an easy study to conduct. It's not an easy study to background. The chairman mentioned that the committee could look at some of the legislation from last session. I've got a whole drawer full upstairs. I worked for 141 very creative thinkers, and I can tell you, I think pretty much everything you can think up, I wrote up some way or another, or at least tried to. So we've got stuff we can look at and talk about. The mill levy reduction grant program, the relief thing, was a buy down of about 75 mills for a couple bienniums. And I attached a part of the 2012 property tax statistical report as an appendix. And if you look at the bottom of that appendix, down where the years 2008 to 2012 are reflected, And the first subtotal number there, total ad valorem taxes, in 2008, statewide property taxes, $776 million. 2009, almost $1 million was trimmed off of that through the mill levy reduction grant program, but then almost $50 million was tacked on in 2010. In 2011, that program was continued, but another $36 million was added to property taxes, and you can see by 2011, that number almost matches the 2008 statewide number. And then in 2012, the number exceeded the 2008 number. So that's what I was talking about. If you look at a graph, there's a bump, there's a dip, and the rise continues, and now where we're at on that graph is about where we were in 2008. Now in 2013, the additional relief provided by the state will create another dip. The concern is, what's that growth line going to look like after that dip? How fast is that going to come back up to where we are in 2012?
John, what's the difference between special taxes and special assessments?
Special taxes, that category includes things like mobile home taxes. I'm not sure if it's in lieu of taxes paid by some entities on property. Sarah knows for sure what that.
Mr. Chairman, I know of a few. mobile home tax, the woodland tax, the payment in lieu, the electric generation transmission distribution tax. They're pretty much taxes that aren't value-based. They are from a different source.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sarah.
And then the special assessments are treated separately here, so they are not part of special taxes. Is TIF district money part of that special taxes, or is that in the ad valorem number? Okay. Well, anyway, we can explore all of these statistics in more depth at a future meeting. But in looking at the information, I just put together this little table that's on page one about 2009 to 2012. 2009, we had a drop of 12.6. 10, we went up 6.4, 11, we went up 4.9, 12, we went up 7.5. It looks to me like something's happening in the second year of the biennium on the property tax side. I have no idea what it is, but I think we should try and figure out if there's something driving a bigger bump in year two. And then, you know, I didn't want to get into the memo on talking about exactly how to control growth, but there are three things that North Dakota has relied on traditionally. We've got some limits in state law. We've got valuation governed by state law. There's an issue, the governing body self-restraint, that local officials are going to levy what they need and not impose a greater burden than necessary. After all, they pay property taxes in those districts as well.
Chairman. Representative Casper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, could I go back to your appendix for the year 2012, on the bottom of the page you were just talking about? Just want to clarify, on the bottom you're showing the rural real estate ag is $198 million, and and then there's ag in the city of 963,000, so it's roughly 200 million of rural property tax, or ag property tax, compared to the residential 340 some million. Is that right? That is this all of the statewide numbers?
Yeah, that looks right.
So the residential is 150 million roughly more than the ag land throughout the state.
That looks right. Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Now, I stole this table from the tax department's report, and at some point in the future we'll have the tax department go through any questions there might be. Sarah Meyer is going to go through that statistical report briefly today, just to give you an overview of what's in there so you know what kind of information we already have in hand. The third factor is taxpayer and citizen participation. It's close to the restraint by governing bodies. Are taxpayers holding up their end of the deal, letting local officials know their feelings on property taxes? I don't know, and I don't know how you measure that or how you encourage that, but we do have legislation now that we referenced earlier about the zero increase notice that goes out to taxpayers and the notice of assessment increases that goes out to taxpayers. Those are intended to let taxpayers know what's going on in the process, and short of herding them into the meeting room, at least let them know that they have the opportunity to participate. Now, that's about all the background I could really come up with. I think, as was reflected in the discussion earlier about how does the state extract itself from this at some point in the future, the legislature has really put itself in a position as a property taxpayer in every taxing district in the state. And as such, I guess the legislature will share taxpayers' pain, but it is an important consideration how deep is that poll going to get. The state's current rate of revenue growth won't last forever, so I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But
no, but you're just painfully bringing it back up again, don't
well,
you?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is I think that In looking at all of these issues during this interim, we've got to think way beyond next session.
Committee comments? Any comments from interested parties here? Jerry, I think you might have some information for us from the cities. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Jelmstead. I'm here on behalf of the North Dakota League of Cities. Just thought I'd provide the committee with some background information. The League of Cities compiles this information from information submitted to us by the county auditors every year. So it shows the different levies for the North Dakota's 357 cities. On the cover there, you can see the last 5 years of what the level of mill levies are for the different cities in North Dakota. You can see in 2012 there was one city levying over 200 mills. And down at the bottom of the next chart down there on the cover, it shows the high and average and low for county, school, city, and park district levies. You see under the city levies there, the high was 422.20 mills. That was the city of Perth up in Towner County. They're a population of 9. And 1 mill in the city of Perth brings in $9. So just to give you an idea, that's the extreme levy there. Otherwise, everybody's under 200 mills. Of North Dakota's 357 cities, the smallest is Russo in McLean County, population 4. And of course, the largest being Fargo with over 105,000 people. The average size city right now in North Dakota is 1,418. The closest city to that population would be the city of Park River in North Dakota. And the median city is Rutland at a population of 163. So half of our cities are below 163 population and half are above 163 city of Rutland. Turning it to the inside cover there, we've got some history on the last 5 years of the average tax levies in North Dakota cities, the average county levy, school levy, city levy, and park district levy. You can see there that for school levies in 2009, there was a substantial drop there with the change in the school funding. So what the average school levy was dropped from 190 down to 124. It's also interesting to note that the levies for county, school, city, and park district in 2012 are all less than they were in 2008, their average mill levies. Turning over to page 1 of the report, we have the taxable valuation for each city. We also show the state and county levy, and that includes the 1 mill for the state medical school. That's the state portion of that levy. The school levy, the city levy, the park levy, and then on the other, we have things such as fire districts, ambulance districts, other levies that aren't from a political subdivision, and then their total levies. If you look at the taxable valuations, they're starting with Adams County. One mill would be 1/1,000th of their taxable valuation. So for the city of Bucyrus, for example, 1 mill raises $28. If you put that period where the comma is, $28 for 1 mill in Bucyrus. City of Hettinger, 1 mill would bring in $1,829. So if you take each of those levies that they have for each of those entities for school, city, park, and so forth, you can easily determine how much is being collected based on what 1 mill brings in for each of those cities. As I mentioned, we have 357 incorporated cities. If you look through this report, you'd come up with 364 because listed on page 9 are the 7 cities in North Dakota that are in more than one county. So they have they send their budgets to 2 different counties. So we have 364 cities that would be listed on this report, but actually 357 total cities. And then on the also on page 9, it shows the totals there, the state averages for the state and county, school, city, park, and other, what those levies would be, coming to a total state average of 297.58 mills for North Dakota City. Be happy to try to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? You look at this report inside the page and you look at the county average levy and the school levy and the city levy and the district park district, it appears that all of you are lowering property taxes. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, their mill levies have gone down.
Well, you were careful.
There's new valuation that's come in some cities, of course, and I think it's probably important to note that in over half our cities are below 200 people, and their valuations are not tending to go up. So they've basically been operating on the same funds for the last several years because they're on a zero growth rate budget, so they're operating on the same amount of property tax that they have for the last number of years.
At the beginning of this meeting, I commented that there's 3 different ways to measure property tax burden: the actual dollar amount, the mill levy, and the effective rate. You just give us a report here that shows the mill rate.
Right.
That measurement of tax burden is going down. I can look in the red book from the state perspective, and I can see that the effective rate is greatly going down. Yet I look at the report that Mr. Walsted just gave us, and I can see that property taxes collected, total ad valorem taxes, have gone up from $776 million in 2008 to $814 million in 2012. And I think there lies, boy, it'd be nice if somehow we all communicated with the same language.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you can see that there's been an awful lot of new construction that has happened in the last couple of years, and a lot of new property going on the tax rolls.
Representative Casper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you be able to give us this exact same chart in the exact same format with one exception? Instead of putting in the mills, put in the total dollar amount of property taxes collected annually by these entities. So just put in dollars collected in property taxes and get rid of the mills.
Mr. Chairman, I think we'd be able to do that, right, based on their taxable valuation and what the mill levy was. We'd be able to show that what the number of dollars they collected in each of those for what period were you looking for?
Or? The last 5 years. So you have five separate charts like this, so we could actually see dollars increased.
Mr. Chairman, we could give that information. The only thing that wouldn't show is that the taxable valuation wouldn't show whether that's the same property or whether it's new construction. And
Mr. Chairman, I don't care about that. I'd just like to see the dollar amount collected.
My guess is they will care about that because it's...
Well, sure they will. I'd just like to see the gross number.
Yeah. Jerry, see what you can do there. Also, you put this report together... And you have for years, I take it?
This goes way back into the 70s.
2013 data? We figure this is a report you think that you can deliver here by January?
We normally have this done by the first of the year, depending on gathering the information from the county auditors. Once in a while, there's a county that has a computer glitch or something, so it takes a little while to get the final report, but... We normally have it done by the 1st of January.
Okay. So we could see this again updated in January.
Yeah, we'll be putting it out for sure.
Right. Other questions? Senator Sorbach.
Mr. Chairman and Jerry, if you're going to break out the total dollars, which you were asked to do, if it's possible, is there a way that you could separate what's new property and which is existing in the valuation, or is that beyond information you have? Because the total number means nothing unless we look how much of it's new valuation and how much of it's just existing property growing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yeah, that's the point I was trying to make, is that we wouldn't be able to break that out. We'd have to get that to the... We've never broken that out before, but I don't know if that would be information that would be available to the assessing departments or from the county tax equalization directors or not. They must have a way of finding that information because they base their budget growth on that new property, the zero mill levy increase.
Jerry, let's just revisit this issue in October, and maybe by then you can do whatever you need to do to find out what information you might be able to give us. In January, if you can.
Mr. Chairman, maybe to clarify what Representative Casper was looking for, you're looking for the dollar amount raised by all these different taxing entities, school, city, park, for each city?
That's true, Mr. Chairman. It's I'm looking for gross dollars raised by each of those entities for these, wherever you have the mill, it should be a dollar
right.
value raised. And for what I'm interested in, I don't care whether it's new money, old money, new growth, whatever. Now, some other committee members may like a breakdown, and that's certainly their prerogative. But what that would tell me is what the budgets are doing.
Why don't you just ask for the budgets?
Because I don't want to do all the work compiling the data if he already has it in this type of format. This is a very nice format, so if you get the budgets, then you got to try to figure out the budgets. This is a great format.
This will not reflect the budget. This will reflect only what part of the budget is paid with property tax.
Correct.
Okay. Senator Sorbaugh.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I'm understanding, but it says what each mill is worth, so if you just multiply the value of the mill by the mills done, you should have the numbers you want for any entity within any city. All you have to do is look at the mills and the mill valuation and multiply the two numbers.
Right, Mr. Chairman, if you take the taxable valuation by the total levies, that'll be the calculation that we would add to the, to get the dollars.
Communicate with John.
Okay.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any? Terry Trainer, Association of Counties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity. Terry Trainer, Association of Counties. As Jerry mentioned, the data to drive that report is collected from the county auditors. And when I spoke to them 2 weeks ago about your request for information, they reminded me of this data gathering effort by the league, and they said anything in addition to that that is gathered there, if it could be done concurrently, if there was something else that the committee felt it would be helpful to do it at the same time, because of course it is a kind of a compressed process for the counties to turn all those many budgets into mill levies into a tax statement in the time period we're talking about. So if they could do one data collection effort, that would be great. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I would like to comment on the discussion that you just had about new property and old property. I think that is a huge point. The fact that our property tax has grown, the property tax collections, I think you could say is a good thing in this state, because we have had in the period that the memos talk about, $350 million of new property tax from property that wasn't there before. Most of that growth, more than half of that growth, I would say close to three-fifths of that growth in property tax collections is new property. And that's a good thing for the state of North Dakota. When you look at just property that was existing at the start of that period, the growth in property tax is about 3% a year. It changes. Some years it's 6%, some years it's less than 1% on existing property, depending upon the needs of the various political subdivisions. But over that 10-year period, it's about a 30% growth, about 3% a year. And that, I think, is the discussion of whether that's reasonable or unreasonable. But I think the gross dollars of increase in tax collections in North Dakota is a good thing, because it is really reflective of how much new property, improved property, that's happening in the state of North Dakota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jerry Trainer, I've never seen you so passionate before.
Bully for North Dakota.
Bully for North Dakota. Thank you, Terry. Questions for Terry? Thank you. Yeah, we do have. Okay. Senator Dotson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Terry. You know, we got a couple of these letters from the Williston area about what's happening in their auditors, and I think that the requirement of in the counties and a lot of counties to send these notices out. And I don't know if your association has had a discussion about that or not. I think the legislature wanted to make sure that the people that are going to pay these taxes get some notice and get be notified of what's happening, so that it doesn't catch them by surprise, and that it's sort of a transparency type of thing. But it is going to cost something to do this, and it's not going to be really paid by the state directly. It's going to be paid by the local subdivision. Have you all in your discussions come up with a proposal or a way that we could do this without having to have it cost this much, or a different way of notifying, or to do it maybe every third year instead of every year? Or is there a way around this, or are we kind of stuck with, if we want to keep this notice going, that we're going to probably have to just put up with the cost and the inconvenience? And have you talked that over?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dotson-Rod, we've certainly talked about that a lot, particularly during the session when there was a discussion of having the threshold for doing that, which of course would increase the number. We recognize the importance of notifying the taxpayers so they have that opportunity. Unfortunately, it hasn't brought out a lot of people to take advantage of that opportunity. But really, I'm probably not the one to talk about this issue, because the assessment official sends it out, and the vast majority of the assessment is done by city assessors and township assessors. Now, counties do assessment where the townships and the small cities don't, but the burden falls on the cities and the townships for those notices.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Terry, that's true, but in most of the counties, I think the township work effectively ends up being a county function. So, I mean, I think that if the county isn't directly involved in, you know, officially determining that, they are functionally involved in, and probably done under the direction of the county tax director. So, at least in the county I'm in, that's, it's mostly a county operation. So, well, maybe it's just something we need to be aware of, and probably we'll probably see this again in the next session.
Senator Dotson-Rodd, the vast majority of Morton County lives in Mandan, and the county will have absolutely no effort whatsoever in sending that letter out. It'll be simply a burden on the city of Mandan. And Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This isn't a question for Terry. It's more of a comment that if we only get, you know, the increase in budgets over the past few years, that doesn't tell us anything, really. I know if there's expansion in the city, new division, streets, curb gutter, water, electricity, all those things cost money, and I'll bet that isn't all made up in the first year of taxes. Or if a plant that they've given 2 years or 10 years exemption to wants to move in, they still have to provide the infrastructure to that. And so I think we need a lot more information than what those budgets have gone up. We need what it has cost to get those budgets where they're at, who's paying those taxes, what that new infrastructure or new taxable property is. Otherwise, it doesn't tell us anything other than, yeah, the budgets have gone up. Why have they gone up? We need to know that as well.
Representative Kelch, if a city grows tremendously in new property, or if a county does, at some point one might think that existing property owners should see some tax reduction because there's more paying the tax. I would hope, though, that as we move forward in January, if you live in a taxing district and you can't show where you have 40% tax reduction since 2009, that we can find out why. And I think that, because that'll look at existing property, and that's my hope. I don't know if we'll get there, but we're going to try. Go ahead.
2009, because that's very important. There's a lot of information out there. You're going to get a 40% tax reduction, and
you've never heard it from me.
That's not true, and I think we need to make that clear. That,
right now.
Plus the fact, you know, and that's not all, and that's an average. There's going to be differences all over the place. So.
You're exactly right. Senator Dotson-Rodd, the bill that we passed last session that requires the notification, we can certainly look at that during this interim to see if there's ways we can reduce the burden. I don't know if we still need the newspaper requirement if they're sending out the letter, but I would remind you and this committee that that was a result of a compromise that kept caps from being imposed. We found some neutral ground there between the House and the Senate, and it was sunshine instead of caps, and I think it was a good compromise, and I believe all the political subdivisions were involved in support of it. Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other comment on the property tax relief. I think we need to start saying that we should see an average of 40% reduction in our tax bills if there had been no state tax reduction at all. Then we would have a full 40%. But to convolute it like I see a lot of things happening. It worries me what the people are going to say. Well, everybody says we're going to get 40%, and they're getting maybe 20 to 25. And that's where we might run into more problems than we think.
There are some who are going to run into problems. I get asked in Mandan, I tell them, I hope for a 25% reduction over your last tax bill. And you're right, it's 40% is a cumulative. Any other comments from people? Here we go.
Senator Cook, members of the committee, Annette Bendish from the North Dakota School Boards Association. John Martinson sends his regrets. He is out of town at our national executive directors conference. He wishes he could be here, but before he left, he prepared this draft that I just passed out to you. This is the information that Mr. Martinson intends to query from our school districts regarding the tax levies they collected in 2002 and then the tax levies they will be collecting in 2003 under the new funding formula restructure. And he asked that I present this to you for any comments that you might have on the information that he intends to collect. Based on some of the comments that I heard this morning, I think we may also want to query our school districts on some of their budget information and their salary data, too, and we can certainly ask that information of our business managers when we send this query out.
I apologize, Ms. Bendish. I was looking all over for John. That's right. I remembered he said you were going to be here instead, you're a lot more welcome than he is, though.
Thank you.
I thank John. John's been working hard on making sure we get us information. I want you folks to look at it. You need more information than what he has here. I think this should be everything we need to really identify the consequences of the mill levy buy-down and this last bill that we just passed regarding how it affects school property taxes. See you in January.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. All the way from Minot, Mr. Turnus.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, Kevin Turnus, City of Minot, Assessor. I would just like to give you a snapshot of what's going on. Some of the topics you're asking about or we're discussing, I'll give you what's going on right now. So Minot Homestead Credits. Representative Casco was worried about that. We're up from about 130 homestead credits, which is only about 1%, almost less than 1% of our total taxable value. A few people that have parcels out there, and that might double with what you did. You increased the salary limits. We're up to about 200 now. We've been on the TV, letters of dinner, trying to let people know about what you folks did. And we're trying to get, but I don't expect more to double that. I was looking for 5 times that amount. Giving seniors qualified, and so it's not happening yet. Regarding the market in Minot, the first half of the year looks like it's leveled off. I can tell you last year's taxable valuation from last year to this year, Minot's tax valuation is up about 29%. Huge increase. We've never seen that kind of increase. You're asking how much of that's new construction. For us, it's over half is new construction. The rest is 13% rough increase. So the 29% increase in Minot, 13% of that is the old stuff that went up in value, and the rest is all new construction. Our lanes of miles that we have to plow and keep track of has almost doubled in the last 3 to 4 years in Minot. You can talk about all that new construction that's coming on the tax roll to feed in the property tax system, but you know, when you have a 45 to 50 member patrol force and you have 3 or 4 policemen, you're not going to cover as much ground. You're not going to cover all that new ground that you just added. So there's always a sensitivity to that with the increase in the stuff that comes on. And I just wanted to mention that from what we can tell, the first 6 months of the year, it has really leveled off. I think that when it comes to Minot, I wouldn't expect we're going to see much further assessment increases for next year based on the first 6 months of this year. We have people that have started 100 to 150 housing projects. Unit housing projects. One guy came down to Mandan and says that's where all the money's at. So I don't know if we're going to do that. Senator Cook, he's coming down here to build a new place.
Bismarck's Western Upper Class Suburb. It's not Mandan.
Yeah, you were just a bedroom community. That's why you have to offer all those tax exemptions.
Oh, gee, ouch.
So something from
Thank you, Kevin. Anything else?
Things are really slowing down in Minot. So you can talk about this going crazy, assessments going crazy. We're tired of this 15%. It looks like the market has settled down. The first 6 months, we really leveled off. So I don't.
Mr. Chairman.
We hit the wall.
Kevin, I know you're the assessor. You don't put the budget together, but do you want to speculate on what Minot's budget might do as far as the mill rate? What type of reduction in mills?
Well, Mr. Chairman, they're just putting out the preliminary budget probably in the next week or two. I've seen some of the preliminary stuff. Sure, there's a lot of requests. We'd like to have a snow plow. We need the garbage truck. Can't get parts for one of the garbage trucks. And on it goes, you know, but I could probably, yeah, there's an expert on it. He might have a supplier. But I would say that if you look at just the taxable increase, the value of the mill has gone up about 29%. If you allow for a 3 or 4% increase in the cost of government, basically what we have right now, and ask for a little bit more to service the new construction that's out there, the new lane miles, the new this and the population, I would hope that the city is going to make a cut in the mill levy, but whether it's going to be 30% to wash that out, I don't see how they can do it.
Okay.
But yeah, I would hope there'll be a cut. Maybe there'll be a cut in the county in part two, because their value of the mill is up 30%. And that won't happen.
29% increase in property, you're sending out a lot of letters notifying.
Thank you for bringing that up. I know you want to get rid of me before lunch, but that's another thing I wanted to discuss. We sent out about 13,000 letters of increase last year. I had 12 people show up. It's good for people to know, but they all get that letter in April and they say, well, my house is worth more than that. The neighbor sold his. And they put the letter, and they call the times and try to maybe they don't make the connection that could affect the business.
Well, hopefully the way the letter is worded, it makes it very clear that it will. But you also said at the beginning you're going through a fair amount of expense, advertising, et cetera, to tell people a chance for their taxes to go down. Isn't that kind of the same as understanding the need to spend some money if your taxes are going to go up?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'm not spending any money to tell people about the homestead tax.
Okay.
That is press releases, letters to
the okay.
advertising budget.
Okay.
Generally, I don't want to advertise. for my office or
anything. Wise decision.
But we have no, I fully believe that we have never, you've never heard from me a complaint about trying to notify people.
Okay.
If you give us enough time to notify.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
We had a question, Representative Hedlund and Representative Frosseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Turnus, do you think that more of those 13,000 people that you sent to letters would show up if there was any recourse for them to pursue? Or when they open the letter, do they look at it, say, my property tax is up 29%, there's nothing I can do about it?
Except complain and call my legislator.
Mr. Right. Chairman, well, that clearly, of course, it's not the property tax, it's the assessment.
Right.
What we do is we add a supplement to that letter. We add a colored sheet so they see it. We say, if you have information you would like us to consider, a recent appraisal, you're aware of some houses in your neighborhood that have sold, you tried to buy this house, it's currently listed for sale, you had a realtor's opinion, please bring that to the meeting and we will consider it. We've always told people, so you've got to come with something to tell us, to help us out with the data we have. We've always asked for that. It's not there, it's not there. If the evidence isn't there that the assessment's too high,
Representative Frosseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, you said your valuations had gone up at 29%, and I presume quite a bit of that new construction receives a tax exemption for probably up to 5 years. And at what point does that tax exemption, is the 29% include that property, or does that property come on your valuation list at the end of their 5 year exemption period?
Mr. Chairman, there is none of that. We have hardly any applications for the 5 year new business exemption. We don't give it to apartments. The council has not given it to retail. I can't recall the last time we had a 5 year exemption. I would say right now we have less than a tenth of a percent that's currently exempted. I believe that's a grain processing facility, primary sector, which has always been the legislature's focus or was on your upgrade legislation. We don't hardly have any new business property tax exemption. Just now, the council just now last year got rid of the 2-year exemption because they felt there are no incentives that were needed. They'll bring it back someday, I think.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that brings up an interesting point. I kind of thought maybe that'd be your answer, but I know a lot of this new construction that's happening in oil country, people, the commercial properties or residential properties, these developers come in, they don't even ask for it. They probably don't even know about it. I wonder if we should take a look at, wonder if that exemption should continue to exist, if it's really necessary to offer that anymore in state. Maybe there's in some areas, but it seems like it isn't being used like it could possibly be used.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you guys did discuss that last year about that, but we're not using it very much. The Renaissance has been a big thing. There's been a lot of growth in the Renaissance area. But if I could leave you with just one thing, we're always happy to provide you any information we can. The assessor's office, most assessors, and I'm going to speak for the old timers, have always been concerned about the market value. We believe that if we can at least start with a good number, and if you folks want to take some percentage of that, and then that's what we tax, that's fine. We've always felt to at least let's start with a good number. What do we think the property is worth? Because everybody wants that number. It came in wonderfully handy for the flood, when buyouts and all that stuff came out. How much was damaged down there? Well, we had a pretty good number. If we'd have been at 70% or 60% and everybody would have just adjusted their mill rates to collect as much. I just think it's important to try and consider the fact that always starting with a good number is important, and that's where we're at right now. I did also want to mention, if I could just make a suggestion, Mr. Wolstead, on that. When you talk about maybe we should assess at 75% of market or 80%, I wonder if you couldn't get to that part by going to the taxable value. Currently, right now, we take 9% of the true and full value of a residential property, and that's the taxable value of your 9% of the assessed value, pardon me. Maybe you want to play with that percentage a little bit, but we would always just really strongly suggest that at least we have a good number to start with, which is the market value, which is what we are trained as assessors and appraisers to come up with, is the market value. If I can get you any information, feel free to let us know.
We know how to get hold of you.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks, Kevin. Any other comments from interested parties? Okay. Representative Frosseth's question, I think, leads us right into the next agenda item. We got a background memorandum on the effectiveness and accountability of property tax exemptions.
Mr. Chairman, committee members. Yep, just happens. Prepared a memo on that issue. What I did was identified the discretionary property tax exemptions that can be granted by cities or counties. And throughout here I said, by cities for property inside city limits and counties for property outside city limits, so we'll just assume that applies for everything, and it does. And the first one listed here in the memo is the one we were just talking about, the 5-year exemption. The newer expanding business exemption, it doesn't really have a formal name, but in 1969, the legislature created the statutory provision, and it allows a partial or complete exemption or option to make payments in lieu of taxes. The exemption can be granted for up to 5 years for a revenue-producing enterprise, and that's extended to a period of 10 years if that enterprise produces or manufactures a product from agricultural commodities. Another option, the option to make payments in lieu of taxes, can run for up to 20 years, and payments in lieu of taxes can be set at any amount, so it's every bit as good as an exemption if the governing body wants it to be. In addition, there is a state income tax exemption that is available. Got to be approved by the State Board of Equalization, and it is now limited. It doesn't apply to any revenue-producing enterprise. It was recently adjusted. That exemption is available only for primary sector or tourism business.
there's an exemption that's been in law since 1973 for improvements to buildings. This is an optional exemption again. The local governing body has to approve it, but if it is approved, the value of any improvement to property is exempt from property taxes for five years. There we go. And that exemption can't apply to residential property unless it is at least 25 years old prior to the improvement. Tax increment financing is a topic that this committee has in the past taken on as a kind of a separate study issue, and this is obviously a greatly abbreviated version of how it works, but once such a district is established, the existing valuation of the property is frozen for normal property tax purposes, and then any enhanced value as there are improvements made, that enhanced value is subject to tax, but all of the revenue from that tax goes to the tax district, tax increment district fund to pay off any bonds issued for the improvements. Did I hear a question or? Oh, okay. So, TIF might be a topic the committee wants to get more in depth into, that new business thing, perhaps. The new residential property exemption, this has existed for quite a number of years. The value now is up to $150,000, new single family residential property or townhouse and condominium property can be exempted for up to 2 years by the city or county. We had some discussion about that. The Association of Builders certainly supported continuing that possibility of exemption. I don't know that we got an accurate count of how many cities and counties out there are currently allowing this exemption. It's not as many as it used to be, I know that. Early childhood services building, once again, that's local discretion. Pollution abatement improvement exemption doesn't come into play very often. It was put in there for the Heskett plant, I believe, for a substantial improvement that had to be made. Builder-owned single-family residential, I don't know that this is really an issue these days, but it was put in place for builders who built spec homes and were unable to sell them and had to hold them for a period of time. The local governing body, based on local market conditions, can grant an exemption for those kinds of houses if the builder gets stuck holding them for a time. Renaissance zone exemptions, this is another local option, but there is an element of state approval that comes into play with the Department of Commerce approval. There is a listing here of income tax exemptions for Renaissance Zone and then the property tax exemptions that are available. Now, the question to be addressed in this study is how to evaluate the effectiveness of these incentives that exist under current law. The Pew Center on the States released a report in 2012 about evaluating state programs, and they showed North Dakota as trailing behind in that category of endeavor, but they didn't really say why. They didn't say what North Dakota wasn't doing or was doing wrong. They also didn't identify anything that they saw going on in North Dakota, so I'm not sure that they really understand what's going on in North Dakota. There are some things being done here. The Department of Commerce, I think, will be able to help the committee with some of these issues. The Department of Commerce does collect and report and is required to report to this committee grantor reports on business incentives that the state provides. Political subdivisions are required to compile information on business incentives granted by the political subdivision, but those reports are not required to be filed anywhere or compiled by anybody. So I assume obtaining them would have to be from each entity that has granted those, but something that can be explored. So how to evaluate? I don't know. I don't know of any science that says you spent this many dollars on this and here's how many dollars of benefit came back, or here's the benefit that goes to the taxpayers of the district that shared the burden for a time to establish this revenue producing thing. So I guess I'm looking for suggestions.
Committee, this Pew report, I was introduced to this at CSG in Cleveland 2 years ago. I know Senator Grenberg was there also. I think Senator Dotsenrod was there at that report. But it was an excellent breakout session, and I know Senator Grenberg was going to and I was going to work with him to sponsor some legislation to somehow establish some means of measuring the effectiveness of property tax exemptions. And with everything else that was on our plates, we never got it put together before the last session. I'm not sure how the study resolution came about, but I mentioned Pew to John, and that's why you have the report here. As I think back to that session that we had, it was very interesting as I listened to the presenter talk about certain things that other states were doing and what other states were measuring. And I'm wondering if maybe that wouldn't serve our purpose well, is if we could reach out to Pew and see if they'd be so generous as to see if somebody wants to fly to North Dakota and address this committee. And if so, we should set it up, and then if after that discussion we have a consensus or a feeling that we should try to implement something, we can work at putting something together. Other comments, questions? Senator Sorbach?
Mr. Chairman, if you read in the report too, it's mainly we're not considered because all we do is report the information and not evaluate. So if you're going to ask them to come, it'd be also worth communicating what do they need for an evaluation. So if we're going to evaluate, maybe we could use the format or the template or whatever that they're looking for. So we're sure we're comparing apples to apples with other states and stuff. So I would make the request to them, if our reporting doesn't meet that what they call an evaluation, why we're not included, then what do they need? So as this committee goes forward, maybe we can gear our information to that.
Yeah. Good point. Any comments from anybody, any interested parties? Okay. Anything else on this topic? And Representative Frolseth, if you want to look at whether or not these should exist or not, to what degree they should, I would remind you that we did pass some legislation last session that scales it down a little bit, but I would say that that's certainly on the agenda, or could be.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the incentives have a different effect in depending on what part of the state it is, what part of size your community is. I think in larger communities, in larger towns, they probably aren't used as much anymore as a smaller. I know in our town, without some of these incentives, it'd be pretty hard to entice somebody to build a new business building. But in
Bismarck or Williston or Minot, they come in and build them without even asking if they're available, so it, I don't know if it's worth
it. Maybe it'd be worth our efforts, and I know we heard a lot of this during the hearings last session, but just to have some of the local political subdivisions, the major cities, counties, just approach the committee as far as to what degree they use them. We just heard from Minot, they don't. I know Bismarck doesn't, but just to gather some of that information so that we have it. Okay, can we do that, John? Okay, anything else on this? We'll have the 11:45 discussion of directors regarding the committee on effectiveness and accountability perhaps. We've done that. We're almost at noon.
Yeah, we did it.
Before we break for lunch, I should point out that the chairman of the legislative management is here, Senator Ray Holberg. He has been monitoring our actions from the back corner. Welcome, Senator Holberg. Corey, did you want to say anything? We've got a lady sitting next to you. I don't know who she is, and it makes me nervous.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I don't want to take a lot of your time, but since you're ahead of schedule, I do want to take this time to introduce the new State Supervisor of Assessments. As some of you know, Marcy Dickerson, the longtime State Supervisor, who has provided this committee and many of your standing committees a lot of good information and counsel and guidance and harassment over the years, retired as of June 30th, and we're certainly going to miss Marcy. We're having a little event for her this afternoon on the 18th floor at 3 o'clock. I hope that many of you can join us. We planned it so that perhaps some of you could enjoy that send-off for Marcy. But I do want to take this time to introduce the new State Supervisor, who is Linda Ledbetter. And Linda is the longtime county auditor from Steele County. She has been the auditor there for 18 years. She has a very, impressive knowledge of local government, working with cities, the county, of course, school districts, and the other various political subdivisions in the development of budgets and mills and things like that. And she is, I think, going to do a great job. She starts officially tomorrow, but she is here because of the interim committee today and is going to be a part of our event this afternoon. But I hope that you'll get some time to introduce yourselves. I've tried to introduce her to a few of you this morning, and take some time to introduce yourself to Linda. She's going to obviously be working very closely with you as some of these proposals and some of your work evolves, and I encourage you to get to know her. I think she's going to do a fantastic job. She has a strong background. She's been very active in the Association of Counties and the Association of County Auditors over the years. Lots of contacts with auditors, treasurers, and so I just encourage you to get to know her. So thanks very much, and again, I hope to see some of you this afternoon at 3.
She starts tomorrow, and Marcy's long gone. She never got to work with Marcy then.
Well, she'll have her chance. We're going to be, at some point, and when she settles in, she'll get a chance to consult with Marcy. So,
I was kind of happy she hadn't. I figured she hadn't picked up any of my...
Well, that's a good thing and a bad thing, right? Well, along those lines, you're right, Mr. Chairman. There will be no influence there at all. So, but no, Marcy has been very gracious about lending herself out for calls and consultation. But we're going to let Linda get her feet under her and get a grasp of the department, the division. And I know Marcy will be lending herself to Linda throughout the course of the next several months. We've got a very busy time coming up because the equalization process has now come to us. So on the 6th of August, next week, we have our centrally assessed equalization meeting, and the following week is the local assess meeting, where all the locals come to the State Board of Equalization to talk about values. And so Linda is going to be thrown into the fire these next couple of weeks, so it's good. Nothing like being trained by getting thrown in. So,
great.
Thank you.
We will always, well, maybe we'll treat her all right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Corey. Anybody else have any comments to make at all? Okay, we what's on at 1 o'clock? You know, maybe we could start at 12:30. Is that all right? If we come back at 12:30, if we don't have anything where somebody might be sitting here waiting. Okay, we will recess until 12:30. Why don't you send DeCray an email saying he's on?
Yeah, tell him we're
probably a half hour ahead of what's on the sheet.
Okay.
We'll call the tax committee to order again here. John, just one thing before we move on the last memo we had measuring the effectiveness of property tax exemptions. Hidden in the very last sentence of that report, evaluating tax incentives, you make a comment here, section 5460108 requires political subdivisions to compile an annual grantor report on any business incentive granted by the political subdivision. And you go on to say there's no requirement for compilation of political subdivision grantor reports. Do you suppose it's possible for you to request them and see if we might not be able to get a look at them so we get a handle on to what degree they're being used and who isn't using them? And
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can ask.
Jerry, do you know anything about them reports, what happens to them? See if you can at least find out where they're at. And
okay, yeah. The statute just says they should do it, and that's the end. It doesn't require it to go anywhere, so I assume it just ends up in a file somewhere.
But every county and city ought to have one.
If they've granted exemptions. Mm-hmm.
Terry, you know anything about them?
I'm aware of them.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that those that do have the reports on file.
Okay. See if you can get them. Okay. With that, we'll move to the 1 o'clock agenda item. John's got a background memorandum on applying property tax rates against true and full value of property. And I think both the vice chairman and the chairman had bills to try to do that last session.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is kind of a bookkeeping mathematics exercise, but we had some legislation last session for a proposal for a constitutional amendment, because in our Constitution there is a reference to debt limits of political subdivisions based on assessed value of property in the taxing district. And under current law, we've got a definition that assessed value is 50% of true and full value. That was done back in 1981 with the restructuring. Assessed value was set at 50% to keep it approximately where it previously was. It didn't work out exactly the same for every political subdivision, but I guess it was kind of a big picture estimate of what was necessary. We have, in current law, a restructuring from 1981 where true and full value is basically market value for all property types except agriculture, and agriculture is valued based on a productivity formula that, well, we won't go into at this point, but then 50% of that number is assessed value. The only thing assessed value is used for is that debt limit under the Constitution, and to get to taxable value, that 50% assessed value is multiplied times 10% for commercial, agricultural, and centrally assessed property, and 9% for residential property, and the result is the taxable value of those properties. Now, the 9% for residential, I believe the reason that 9% is used for residential property and 10% for everything else is. Residential property is not income-producing property in most cases. The other kinds of property do produce income. The taxable value number, as a result of those calculations, is about 1/20 of the actual market value of property. We apply a mill rate. A mill is 1/10 of a penny per dollar against that taxable value, which is 1/20 of the actual value, to determine tax liability. That is a very cumbersome process. Taxpayers understandably cannot get a handle on how that works. And I've heard comments from legislators for years that this mill thing is impossible to explain to people, very hard to understand. Why couldn't we change it up into something other than mills and something other than this reduced taxable value that's used as the base? Our chairman actually introduced a constitutional measure that would have allowed that to happen by changing the assessed value into the actual market value of property, cutting the debt percentage in half, and then statutorily changes could have been made to adjust accordingly. During discussion of that measure, I think we came to the conclusion that under current law we could probably make these changes as long as we leave assessed value where it is. So what this memo attempts to do is determine how to do that under current law, and the little chart there is my mathematical illustration of how this could be made to work. First of all, under the current method, for residential property you see there, and we've got an assumed market value of $100,000, taxable value is 9% of $50,000, that's $4,500. One mil of tax against $4,500 generates $4.50 tax. 300 mils, which is somewhere near the statewide average, generates $1,350 tax per $100,000 of residential property value. That's an effective tax rate of 1.35%. For agricultural, commercial, and centrally assessed property, the calculation is essentially the same, but when we get to taxable, then we take 10% instead of 9%, and we have $5,000 of taxable value. One mil, basically say the true and full value is the taxable value for ag, commercial, and centrally assessed. So
table four.
Okay. If they're not included in this column, the special taxes and special assessments, what would be some examples then of special assessments that are in this column? What would be an example of something that might be specially assessed and taxed and in this column?
The two that I'm looking at are Fund 2500, which is Irrigation District, and then the other one is Water District. Which
okay,
is
but I'm on page, I'm on table 12, the column that says special taxes and special assessments. And those are in there?
Those two are included.
So they are?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Would there be other types of special assessments that are not of those two types?
I would have to look. I'm not familiar with the different types of special assessments.
Because I think most of us think of special assessments normally as being a project in a city, a special assessment for a sewer project or a curb and gutter or something like that.
Right.
That when they're, if they're not in here, and these are assessed to by counties and are part of the county budget, I guess I'm kind of, it seems like that's quite a bit. It shows $89 million in special assessments.
Right. We don't ask for that, the special assessment information specifically. I don't know if maybe League of Cities has any statistics on that.
But that 89, does that include, I think I understood you to say earlier, that does not include city.
No.
Okay.
Not the bonded, okay. Bonded special assessments.
Sarah, Martin County, we were to take all of the property tax bills that got sent out to all the property owners in Martin County and totaled them all up, and it's going to include the property tax liability and their special assessment liability. Where would I find that total that would be in here, or won't I?
For those that have, like, the curb and gutter,
yeah.
We wouldn't find that in here because we don't accumulate that type of special assessment information.
What determines what's in here? Do you make that decision and request the information, or are you following law?
No, it's we request it from our office. We are to do an audit. Well, I don't know how you can do an audit after the tax bills have already been sent out and tell a political subdivision they levied too much or too little. But we request this information from all of the counties.
That's part of your request for or audit requirement.
Right. Yeah. A couple years ago, when we had the transition from the gross receipts tax for the rural electric cooperatives to the electric distribution, transmission, and generation tax, we had discussion on if we were going to continue to request that information. And I said absolutely yes. We want to have as much information as we possibly can about what is being levied, what is being collected, if we can.
If there was something that this committee wanted that is not in here, would you put it into your request?
I'd have to go through Commissioner Fong, make sure that we can request it, but yeah.
Senator Sorbach.
And Mr. Chairman, well, and I don't know if it's through here or John's research, but I would really like to see some breakdown what these special assessments are for. These are awfully big numbers. I mean, you look at Cass County, it's millions, and then yet you're saying none of what people are paying for in there. It'd be interesting to see a breakdown what really these are and what the others are, because we're only really getting half the information we need to make any type of decision here.
Senator Sorbach, that's the first thing I looked at, too, is the special assessments from Morton County, and I said that number's too low. And so now well, I find out.
Mr. Chairman, something's not jiving.
Well, I find out now.
It'd be nice to see that broke down and know both what's not here and what's being included in this number.
Okay.
Maybe at some point we can have a discussion on what else we want in here. This is... I would hope you all take a good look at this and study it. If there's something that's some information that you would like to see that we need to see,
I do.
Mr. Walston does, but
well, maybe when you throw away table 11 or whatever it was, that could be replaced. When you send out the request for information, perhaps separately identifying taxable value of new property, so that information is available on how much of the valuation increase is from assessment increase and how much is from new property that's on the tax rolls for the first time?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Walstead, we receive a supplementary abstract with our assessment list, which is what we're actually acquiring right now. And on that supplementary abstract, we have a listing of new property, demolished property, so we can track that. The problem is the assessment abstract doesn't always equal what we have on a tax abstract. So we have to do a little bit of number crunching to figure out just how much. We can figure out percentages, but actual dollars, it's not going to work really well.
So if the committee wanted to look at information at the next meeting or one subsequent, you would be able to provide something from that assessment abstract showing how much of this valuation growth is old property and new property by county or whatever?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Walstead, we capture the county total from this, the supplementary abstract.
Is that what we...
Well, John, I think we need to just sit down and have... I need to digest some of this stuff here. But I'm looking at two reports that I've got. One that the League of Cities puts time and effort into it, and the counties are giving them all kinds of information. Counties are giving you all kinds of information. Part of me is saying, can't we get to one report, one entity taking the effort, and make sure that the report has what it is that legislators want. And generally, legislators will want much more than what is ever really needed. But...
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know how the League of Cities gets their information so early and why we have to wait.
We'll sit you at the table. Senator, Representative Kelch.
Mr. Chairman, I was just kind of wondering, if a city gives a 10-year tax break, say 5 years for a new business, and then after the 5th year they start collecting some tax per agreement, is that in lieu of taxes or is that under normal taxes? Is that just in lieu or under normal taxes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelch, I would say that's probably underpayment in lieu, more than likely. The exempt property doesn't typically go on the assessment list as a portion. It's usually 100% or nothing.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dotson-Rod.
Just again, sir, you know, I kind of think that $89 million is all special assessments. I do think the cities are in there. I think that number, it seems that looks familiar, and it seems to me I'd gotten some information from the tax department during the session on special assessments. So I think that number includes all of the city special assessments, curb and gutter, and sewer. I think that's in there. So you may want to check on that.
I'll check it.
Yep.
Any other questions? Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify what you just said to make sure I understood that. So an exempted property, be it a 2-year house or 5-year, you know, business and whatnot, and then if afterwards it is, shall we say, you know, it's a step-up model, you know, paying property tax, it doesn't go, it's not considered on the property tax rolls as new property until it hits 100% of the property tax it's owed. Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Owens, in answering Mr. Kelch's question, I said that it would probably be more on the payment in lieu rather than the ad valorem taxation. It usually doesn't go on as an incremental assessment. It's usually all or nothing for an ad valorem tax.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Before we go into the forestry stewardship tax, let's just talk one more time about property tax issues and what we want to see on our next agenda. And I think one of the items that's slightly been touched on, it was addressed in a piece of legislation. I don't believe it had my name on it, Representative Doctor. So Representative Doctor thought the only bills we needed to look at were bills, failed bills that I introduced. And but that was a bill that dealt with I called it expanding the tax base. It talked about, in lieu of property taxes or a smaller tax percentage for certain properties that are tax exempt today. And I think we should look at that. I also think that we need to go through a little exercise here so we all understand it about local budget building is what I call it. And so if we could have a city or a county walk us through the steps that they take. They've got two options as they build their budget. And but walk us through so we know what property is included in new property, what property is not, so we have a good understanding of that issue. I got 1981 written down here. 1981 seems to be a year where a lot of things happen. It's been referenced in a lot of the background memos. That's when we found the second option for local governments to build budgets. That's when the ag property was switched over to a production formula. That's the result of the lawsuit, Sioux Railroad. When was your first session, John?
I started right after the 81 session ended because my predecessor apparently committed suicide or something. He vanished.
My point is that there is... My point is there was a lot of discussion on property taxes 32 years ago, a lot of it, and a lot of major tax reform decisions was made by the legislature, and we are feeling the consequences of those decisions yet today. And so as we move forward, number one, don't you commit suicide. But maybe we can, you know, study a lot of these issues, get a good understanding of them. If we can solve some things, we'll do it.
Like a little broader history of what happened just before and during that session?
I don't know if that's necessary. It might not hurt, though. I can remember 81, believe it or not. I specifically remember what interest rates were and what they were doing to farmers, what they were doing to small businessmen. And I know that those high interest rates drove a lot of decisions in the 81 legislative session. But that's the background that's in my mind. But what other things? Anything else? Representative Kelsch?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we're going to find out what House and states are eliminating the mill levy, use of the mill levy, some examples, you know, or two, three examples of how they're doing that. From the memorandum here, I think it would, at least under the residential, may be more confusing than it is now. You know, the 10%, but when you get the nine, how you get, why is it 90,000 instead of 100,000? Well, that's the way it used to be, 9%. And so I think we need some specific examples of how they're doing it, how long they've been doing it, and things like that, so we can, if we're going to even discuss it, we need to know what's happening there.
And maybe we could do the mathematical exercise of applying the 9% earlier in the equation, could we not? Could we not take 9% times the taxable value?
Or 4.5%.
Well, like in the second?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was... That's what I see as the optional approach to get to like an effective tax rate instead of breaking down all those valuations into smaller numbers and applying a mill rate.
Okay. Representative Hedlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bottom paragraph in the first memorandum that we looked at that talks about, I think it's 57.15.
Oh, that 01.1?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Is that something that we can take a closer look at, you know, during the past legislative session, you know, that actually, that section had been repealed in in a couple of different bills, and I think it lasted right up to the very end. And I'm just wondering if, I think a lot of us believe that that probably aids in keeping property taxes higher than they normally would be if it were to be repealed. And I'm just wondering if there's a conversation, if there's any information available that would help us in making a decision or coming to a conclusion, whether that section of code is still needed.
Well, I would argue, I think if you go back to 81, that's the one piece of legislation that was passed that's caused a lot of unintended consequences. And I can understand why it was passed, but I would assume that that's the exercise we'll go through when we have a local government going through their budget building process. That's, we'll understand exactly how that session allows them to do certain things. So, Representative Casper.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, you're thinking, when you're talking about how local governments build their budgets, we've got the four major local governments, the schools, the cities, the counties, and the park districts, and we've got east and west, and we've got large cities and small cities. I mean, are we going to have enough of a variety of budget-building people that we can visit with so that we get an idea of what, because people might be making different budget-building areas in different places of our state?
I think the exercise will only require one to come, and then after that exercise, we may want to further. First thing is to understand, I think, a lot of the things, and all we need is to go through one of them.
Of course, the school board is going to build a budget totally different than a county.
We can have a school board in a county here, or maybe one city.
In a city.
Yeah, that's fine. They'll all go through the same procedure, so, but anything else? Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned a little while ago about considering and looking into, and I'm not going to use the word mill here, I'll use levy consolidation. And last session, one of the bills did actually give that authority, had it passed, you know, to the political subdivisions. But you're asking for subjects to consider, and what I think would help understand, because that particular bill said, levy authority without all the benefits that are currently in code. Could we get a background paper that described now when and how and what the benefits are of levy consolidation that's already in code now, so we know where we're beginning from?
And then, John, how do we move forward with the study as far as county's taken over some of the social programs, human services.
I have to do some thinking on that.
Well, that'll have to be. We'll yeah. Better get that on the next agenda. So, anything else? Okay, let's go to that last background memorandum on forest stewardship tax study.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is a chapter of our tax title that hardly anybody knew was even out there for a long time, and all of a sudden it flashed into prominence. The provisions were enacted in 1967, the idea being native woodlands, if preserved in that state by the landowner, would be eligible for a reduced tax rate. And at that time, it was established by law that eligible property would be subject to tax at a rate to determine equitable by the county commissioners and the state forester, which is really a unique way of setting a tax rate, but in 1973 there was a revision. It was no longer the native woodland tax, it was changed to the woodland tax to recognize that planted forest cover could be included. Then in 1991 it was changed into what it really is now,
the name as well. The forestry stewardship tax was added. The Board of County Commissioners of the county had to approve by resolution application of this woodland tax, or forest stewardship tax, in the entire county. And then someone with wooded land of the suitable size had to apply to the county. They referred the request to the state forester, who decided if that was enough acreage and it was maintained in the state it was supposed to be, give the okay, and then a fixed tax rate of 50 cents an acre was set. That seemed to function just fine for the longest time. But during that time, the state was completing detailed soil surveys for every county in the state, and in recent sessions, by legislation, have required the use of those detailed soil surveys. Well, the assessors started looking at the soil underlying this forest cover and determined that the soil type is a very high grade, high value agricultural soil, and applying the soil survey, the valuation of course went very high. Now, this was happening in counties where the county had not approved the forest stewardship tax. The forest stewardship tax, 50 cents an acre, done deal. In other counties, there were a lot of qualifying woodlands that were not under that treatment, and it is probably because for years the assessor looked at it and said, it's not producing anything. We're going to assess it at a very low rate, and so it probably didn't raise an issue. But now, recognizing the soil under there, so a lot of the owners of those properties got huge assessment and tax increases, duly notified their legislators, as everyone should do, and we had legislation in the last session that would have made some changes. Senator Holmberg was the sponsor, and I worked on the thing with him and talked to some people and considered some options. He put in a piece of legislation, and the state forester appeared in support. The Game and Fish Department appeared in support because they have a similar program to encourage woodland retention, and had walked into a bit of a hornet's nest at a meeting up in Rolette where these assessments had been delivered to landowners, and they thought it was somehow Game and Fish's fault, I guess, I'm not sure. Anyway, in working through this thing during the session, options were considered. Some of the information gathered is detailed in the memo, but what it boiled down to in the end was that it did not appear that there was an adequate basis of information for legislation that would solve the problem in counties that didn't have the forest stewardship tax and not upset the apple cart in the counties that did have the forest stewardship tax. So here we are with an interim study to try and sort those issues out.
Committee members,
if you look at the top paragraph on the back page of this memorandum, you will see what John just referenced. There are 658 landowners already enrolled in the forestry stewardship program. You'll see a list of the eight counties that have, by county action, established the forestry stewardship tax. And John's right, there was a property taxpayer in a county other than one of those eight. I think he had 80 acres of woodlands. The taxes got kind of high. He went for that 50 cent an acre tax rate. His county didn't have the forestry stewardship program. They didn't want to. He came to us. We certainly, I don't think the bill made it to the House. Just, it did? Okay. We passed it. You killed it.
No, it didn't get killed. It's this study resolution.
Well, it got turned into a study, yeah, yeah. So we got to have a discussion on what it is, what direction you want to go. I think there's three or four issues into this thing. You have a policy decision as to what degree do you want to motivate somebody through a lower tax rate to put land into trees and keep them into trees. And if that is a route you want to go, what should the tax rate be? 50 cents an acre was established a long time ago. Should it be higher than that, or is that all right? You still want to leave the decision up to counties as to whether or not they have a stewardship program or not. These are some of the policy decisions that we need to make. And I will add one other thing, that the 80 acres that the gentleman wanted to pay 50 cents an acre on, there was a farmer in that committee who would have been happy to buy the land, take the trees out and plant potatoes. So, I mean, that's the other issue that's out there. And look for opportunities to do such a thing. Okay, Representative Frosas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have a clear understanding what constitutes a forestry area? Like it says in here somewhere, 60 feet wide by a minimum of 5 acres. I know in our area there's a lot of these field shelter belts that would qualify for that amount of space of trees, and a lot of those are being eliminated now because of, basically I think because the trees are old and dying for several reasons, and so they're being worked up and putting back into one big crop. Is there a record of any of those being in the program, and when they come out, is that land placed back into the regular tax base, or do we need to know some of those things, or?
Do we need the state forester here, I suppose?
I believe we do. I was intending that at the next meeting, the state forester would review.
Is there anybody here today that wanted to speak to this issue?
Dwayne,
did you? Why don't you go ahead and, go ahead and do it now.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The game and fish is, Mr. Wallstate kind of alluded to, kind of walked into a hornet's nest earlier when the soil evaluations came out. And our concern, of course, is that forested lands tend to be excellent habitat for wildlife. And we hate to see that wildlife habitat go away on a wholesale scale. And farming practices have changed dramatically in the last 20 years, and equipment has gotten a lot bigger. And what we're hearing from landowners now is that they pretty much valued that at nothing because it was covered with trees and they got no income off of it, so they really didn't consider it part of the operation. Well, now that the taxes have gone up on it so much because of the soil surveys, there's kind of a feeling out there amongst landowners, if they have to pay that kind of tax on it, they just as soon rip out the trees and start planting it and using it for production agriculture. And so our interest, of course, is we would like to see a taxation system that would encourage that to remain wooded instead of being torn up. Just as a point of interest, we have a color map on our Wildlife Division Chief's wall that shows how in Canada those native forests, pretty much, we're talking pretty much the Pembina Gorge in the northeastern area of the state, the majority of this is at. If you look at that aerial photo, Canada pretty much has already kept all their woodland acres, and then you can just tell by looking at that photo where the border is into the United States. And so maybe a thought would be to just look to see what Canada does with it. I don't know if that would have any value or not, but it's a thought we've had in the office to see what Canada's policy is and why theirs has remained wooded and ours is a tendency to being torn up. And so, you know, we would like to see a policy that would encourage the retention of native woodlands. Just as a sidebar, you know, we spun the lottery on the deer licenses this week. We have 44,000 people that did not get a deer license. That's not people that didn't get their first choice. That's people that didn't get a deer license. And of course, that's tied directly to habitat and weather. And so the legislative is a policy branch. I mean, if you want to to continue to be able to provide, you know, suitable wildlife numbers that people can enjoy the outdoors and their hunting and fishing, we've got to have policies that reflect that. And I guess that would be our only statement from the department.
Representative Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm somewhat confused on this. You have planted acreages, which are usually planted on class 2, 3, or 4 lands, which is converted cropland in most cases. And those you can use native species to be planted in those type of scenarios, which provide benefit to wildlife. And you also have the native stands of woodlands that are grazed woodlands. So would grazed woodlands be taxed at the 50 cents as would planted woodlands, as would be woodlands along the river in northeast part of the state that are not grazed?
Well, I would, you know, I would hope that a policy would reflect not only the soil type but also the use. As a former township assessor, that was the kind of the way we went about it, you know, is what the income potential was off the land is kind of how we set what it should be assessed at and taxed at. Well, now that we've gone strictly to a soil survey, that's kind of taken the power away from the local assessor to do those types of things. So, you know, maybe modify that somehow. We certainly don't have anything against grazed forests. In fact, we're thinking about having a bumper sticker that made eat beef, save a prairie, because, you know, so that's certainly a policy that I think that it wouldn't hurt the committee to look at as you're going about this.
You say take the power away from the local assessor. I heard you say, what I actually heard was power away from a local assessor not to be uniform like they're supposed to be throughout the state. But
well, I wouldn't disagree with you, Mr. Chairman. I know as a local assessor that there was a lot of things that went into those assessing that weren't exactly kosher. I mean, if you were a landowner that didn't live in the township, your property usually had a tendency to be assessed a little higher than people that were living in the township. And, you know, I know, Senator Cook, you've spent a lot of your career trying to fix that. And
I didn't want to get you off on that, Ted. I'm sorry.
I don't blame you.
Okay, any questions for Dwayne? Committee, direction, what do you want to do? You want to look at options? You want to? Representative Casper.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I think we should look at options. But second thing is, on a lighter note, I was sitting here thinking about another issue on this problem, and that is our environmental issue. Trees produce carbon dioxide. Trees produce more carbon dioxide than planted fields. Are we going to increase our North Dakota carbon footprint and destroy our air in North Dakota with more carbon dioxide if we allow more trees to be built and grown and encourage it?
Okay. Good comment. Anything else? John, let's have the forester here at the next meeting so that we can get an idea of what it is, and if it possible, have somebody from the counties that have such a program in place to, whether it's through the Association of Counties that we get their message, or if somebody wants to come themselves and talk about any issues they have locally. And have we seen any counties that have had a forestry stewardship program eliminate it?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. But,
okay.
Might also be useful. During the session, consideration was given to pegging this into non-cropland values. Maybe looking at non-cropland values for per county would be a useful comparison.
That's an option. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I know everybody's kind of seeing the end here and wants to get going, but I would like to hear from the tax department on this. I don't know if it was a policy in the past that they're no longer following, but I thought the trees on a quarter were discounted when the taxes were computed on that quarter, that they took out ditches, wetlands, sloughs, trees, that they were not included even though the soil type under those trees might be very good. I always thought that there wasn't, maybe that was done in the past and no longer done. But I had understood that that was what, when a quarter was assessed, that there was a discount. And maybe I misunderstand that?
Oh. The Kapol stepped up to the podium.
Waddled up to the podium.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dotson-Rodd, that is a practice that is still used. If you have wooded area, you can use a modifier to adjust the value of that soil to something that reflects the actual capability of that land. Either a modifier or an adjustment for actual use could be done, but those are left to the county and the township to apply.
They don't have to.
They don't have to. And that's where this situation came from. We had a property owner come to the state board last year. Her property, I think she had 80 acres, riparian, you know, right along one of the rivers in the county, wooded area, wasn't going to be productive for cropland, especially. Probably could have been grazed, but she had approached the county to adjust the value. The value was over $1,000 an acre for wooded, water logged land. Approached the county to adjust the value, and they said no. She came to the state board, and I applied their modifier. The maximum modifier that they had was 40%. So it brought it down to $600 and some an acre. And then another directive to that county was to look at the specific soil types and see if an adjustment needed to be made to those specific soil types that occurred along that river. That went to the soil committee for discussion, and they decided not to do anything. So that soil is still at $1,000 an acre. Modified, it's at $600.
What is she paying now, $600?
She's paying on the 600
yeah.
for value an acre.
Mr. Chairman and Sarah, are counties within the state free to adopt and put on modifiers that they think are appropriate? Can they say, well, there's 5 acres of trees, we'll call that $50 an acre there because that's not being farmed and we'd like to see the trees stay? Can they do that, or are they required to follow a modifier schedule that comes from the state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dotson-Rodd, each county develops their own schedule of modifiers. That schedule of modifiers must be approved by the state supervisor of assessments before they can be used, but that's the only process.
And then they must be used uniformly throughout the county.
That's correct.
Go ahead. Well, Mr. Chairman, I noticed on the sheet the Richland County I'm in, I think, has the highest agricultural taxes per acre in the state. And I think I'm going to check when I get back, but I do think they have a pretty low modifier on trees. I think it's down in that $40 or $50 an acre that they'll put on. And there are a lot of trees in Richland County on a lot of highly erodible soil. And the Cheyenne grasslands area and all that from there, it spreads out over a big area in the county. But it appears that this is really uneven county to county. I don't know how we would quantify that or measure it, but it looks like it's a problem in some places and not in others.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dotson-Rodd, the modifiers that I've seen, and it's an adjustment for actual use, is a flat dollar amount, $30 up to $60 an acre for shelter belts, for natural growth. Marshland falls into that category, something that doesn't qualify for the inundated land classification. So there are counties that are being diligent and being fair when looking at the actual productive capability of that land and adjusting for it, but there are some that are not.
I have a quarter section of land with 2 half-mile long wind breaks planted through it. Do they modify the soil that when the trees are on?
Mr. Chairman, if your county has that modifier, yes, they would.
Maybe I should tell her not to tear them down.
I bet we're paying too. Yeah. Go ahead, Dwayne. Thanks, sir.
Deputy Director of the Game and Fish Department. I got one alibi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. A consequence of two things that are going on right now with the high forest land valuation and then the law that you just passed that says we have to notify a county commission of our intent to purchase land in that county now before we go through any of the process of purchasing. So we started that this summer because we have a couple purchases pending that won't take effect until after the 1st of August or won't be completed until after the 1st of August. So we wanted to make sure we followed the new law as well as with our old process. Is that we were up in Cavalier County where we're purchasing two tracts of wooded areas, and there's other reasons just from the fact that they're wooded. I mean, they do tie in already to existing wildlife management areas and that. But now that that was published in the county's minutes up there, the Game and Fish is buying forested land up there. We've had landowners contacting us now and want us to come and purchase their wooded areas too, because they don't want to pay the tax and they're not getting anything out of the land and they really don't want to tear it up. So if you look at that, you want land to stay in private landowners' hands, you know, that's another way to look at it too. But we thought we should mention that is a consequence of that, those high taxes now on those forested lands, is it is prompting people to contact us and asking us to purchase those tracts.
Okay, thanks, Dwayne. Any other comments, questions, Forestry? Representative Casper?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I need to correct my last statement. Representative Hattelstead pointed out to me that trees produce oxygen and use up carbon dioxide, so all the more reason to preserve those trees.
Thank you for the science. Anything else? Anything else the committee wants to discuss before we adjourn? We will stand adjourned.
You bet. Hey, Scott, how's the summer treating you? Goes by too fast. Huh? Good.